Welcome to the Canadian Nutrition Society podcast, Nutrition Conversations, a podcast dedicated to exploring the latest research in nutrition and health in Canada. In each episode, we invite expert guests to share their insight and knowledge on a wide range of topics, from dietary patterns to sports nutrition, food insecurity, and food sustainability. Whether you're looking to improve your own health and wellness, or simply stay up to date on the latest developments in the field of nutrition, we hope you'll join us on this journey to better understand the role food plays in our lives. Please note that the views expressed by speakers in CNS podcasts are those of the speaker and not necessarily of CNS. Sitting in the host chair in this episode is the Scientific Director of the Canadian Nutrition Society, Dr. Sharon Panahi, who will be talking to Dr. Joanne Arkind on Season 2, Episode 12 of Nutrition Conversations on the role of sodium on our health and strategies to reduce sodium intake without sacrificing taste.
Hello, Nutrition Conversations listeners. We're exploring a topic that affects nearly everyone, salt. While it's essential for our bodies, too much sodium can have serious consequences for our health, including raising blood pressure and increasing the risk of heart disease. We'll uncover the science behind sodium, controversies in the field, its role in our diets, and how we can work towards reducing intake. Joining us on this episode is Dr. Joanne Arkind, who is an associate professor and registered dietitian in the Faculty of Health Sciences at Ontario Tech University. She leads a research program that explores evidence-based approaches to the implementation of nutrition policies and interventions to enhance population-wide strategies aimed at supporting healthy eating, including dietary sodium. Her research addresses behavioral nutritional risk factors across the life cycle, from children to older adults, for both the general public and people affected by chronic diseases. Her work is recognized by awards such as the Heart and Stroke Foundation National New Investigator Award, Hypertension Canada Young Investigator Award, and a CIHR INMD New Investigator Award. It is with great pleasure that I welcome you, Joanne, to episode 12 of season 2 of Nutrition Conversations.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Well, thank you for being here with us. And what's nice, I guess, about this podcast is that after many years of grad school together at U of T, I'm glad we finally have a chance to discuss this in a different context. I do remember one of your seminars from, we used to have seminar days on Thursdays where, you discussed, I think it was your thesis, sodium intake assessment in cardiac patients. At least that's what I recall. So I'm curious to know what initially drew you to this area of research and how you got started in exploring dietary sodium and its impact on health.
Yes, it's actually very fun to reconnect in this format. So I initially started doing research in sodium during my dietetic internship when I was at Mount Sinai Hospital. Like many dietetic internship research projects, the project was quite large and beyond the scope of a year, and I continued it on as part of a master's program. So I was working as a clinical dietitian, and I was doing my master's part-time at U of T, and you're right, it was focused on dietary sodium in patients with advanced heart disease, or what we say chronic heart failure. After several years, I decided I was going to leave my clinical practice and take the plunge and do a PhD, and I continued my PhD in that same line. So running some foundational studies related to dietary sodium in heart failure. After I defended my PhD, I moved over to U of T and took on sodium in public health, which at the time was a very important area, as the sodium reduction strategy for Canada had just been published. And so we were able to be at the forefront of public health research related to dietary sodium. And that was with Dr. Mary Labbe. So since then, I've combined, my clinical background as well as my public health background to conduct research on sodium, as well as looking at several other types of research, like food literacy in children, using technology to support sodium reduction and healthy eating, and lots of other fun things. So,
yeah, well, that's fantastic. I'm looking forward to hearing more about this as we sort of break this down. And so we know that sodium and salt are terms that are sort of often used interchangeably. And I mean, I'll admit I kind of do that sometimes too, but they aren't exactly the same thing. So to start, can you explain the difference between salt and sodium?
Mm-hmm. So most of the sodium we consume comes from salt. And most of that salt is in the form of sodium chloride. So in other words, the sodium and the chloride molecules bind together to form salt. And it's the sodium element of that salt that has negative health impacts. So some countries like the United Kingdom tend to use the word salt more often, and others will refer to sodium. In Canada, we tend to use the word sodium more often, and that's a term that I'll use today. I should also add that most of the sodium in our diet comes from salt that has been added to packaged and restaurant foods. So this is because adding salt is fairly easy, an easy and inexpensive way to enhance the flavor of food, prolong shelf life, and to give food its unique textures and forms. And so that's why we see so much of it in our food supply. In Canada, only about 15% of our sodium intake is coming from the salt shaker or the salt grinder that we would use when adding salt during cooking or at the table.
Right. So thank you for breaking that down. And it's quite fascinating and I guess a little surprising to realize how much sodium we're exposed to through everyday foods and how it sneaks into our diets. And we know not everyone responds to sodium in the same way, and some people are much more sensitive to its effects, as we'll talk about a little bit later. But why is sodium such a big concern when it comes to public health, especially in the context of hypertension and cardiovascular disease?
Mm-hmm. So sodium is an essential mineral that helps regulate fluid balance, nerve function, and muscle contraction. The thing is we need a very small amount of it in order to have our body functioning well. Consuming excess sodium, which many people in Canada and around the world are doing, disrupts that sodium and fluid balance in the body, and it places strain on the kidneys as well as on the heart and blood vessels throughout the body. So over time, this makes the vascular and cardiac muscles become thicker and stiffer, and it makes it more difficult to contract and relax. And so that's why over time, too much sodium increases a person's risk for cardiovascular conditions like high blood pressure or hypertension, as we commonly call it, coronary artery disease, and stroke. And these are among the leading causes of death and disability in Canada, and sodium is a major contributor to that. And so for that reason, Canada and countries around the world have taken up dietary sodium reduction interventions in order to reduce cardiovascular risk in the population. And now there's over 90 countries worldwide that have implemented these national sodium reduction strategies. And dietary sodium reduction is one of nine of the World Health Organization global targets for chronic disease prevention. So it's a major effort globally.
Right. And so beyond cardiovascular, or rather heart disease, is there any evidence linking high sodium intake to other conditions as well?
Yeah, there is. So excess sodium is a significant risk factor for chronic kidney disease. And there's also good evidence that dietary sodium is associated with osteoporosis, so bone health, stomach cancer, as well as to metabolic syndrome and diabetes through its association with insulin resistance. And there are also some studies that suggest there's a relationship between excess sodium intake and cognitive impairment like dementia.
Okay. And so in terms of sodium and its effects on the body, I know you mentioned some of the conditions a little bit earlier, but are there populations or perhaps individuals such as those with kidney disease, diabetes, or perhaps even certain genetic predispositions who are more sensitive to sodium's impact?
Mm-hmm. It's a really good question. One thing I'd like to start with is that there's a common misconception that only older people or people with chronic conditions need to reduce sodium intake. What research shows is that even people who have normal blood pressure levels benefit in the long term from keeping their sodium intake low. So keeping sodium intake low prevents that gradual damage that can occur to the blood vessels and heart over time, and it ultimately can delay the onset of serious health events. So it allows us to live well and healthier for a longer period of time. And with that being said, there are certain segments of the population who are more sensitive to the adverse impacts of sodium or who do benefit from having lower amounts of sodium in their diet as part of treatment for chronic diseases. Some of these reasons are genetic and others are due to age or health conditions. So, for example, African Americans, people of African American heritage, tend to have higher rates of hypertension and sodium sensitivity compared to other racial groups. We also know that sodium sensitivity and the negative impact of sodium becomes more detrimental as people age, and that's why hypertension rates increase as people get older. And then we can look to certain populations who are highly sensitive as well, so where sodium is involved in treatment of chronic conditions. So hypertension is one of those. Chronic kidney disease and chronic heart failure are the two others. In those conditions, reducing dietary sodium as a treatment can have almost immediate benefits on blood pressure and the amount of sodium a person is retaining. So it can help them breathe better, have less fluid swelling in their legs or other periphery. And then we also know finally that if someone has had a stroke or a heart attack, if they do adopt a lower sodium diet, they can prevent a future health event. So for everybody, just to summarize, for everybody, following a lower sodium diet is important for prevention. And then especially in some of those unique cases, we need to be especially diligent at keeping sodium low.
Right. And so it's clear from what you're saying that sodium affects people differently. And obviously those understanding those differences is important. But even with what we know about sodium's impact on health, we know there has been some heated debate in recent years, some controversy in the news and scientific literature, and not everyone seems to agree. And so some recent studies and headlines have suggested that we don't need to limit the amount of sodium. So can you describe a little bit this controversy and your thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. This is a really important topic, and it's created a lot of confusion among healthcare providers and the general public. So it's really important that we clarify what's actually going on here. So just to start, the World Health Organization recommends that people consume less than 2,000 milligrams of sodium per day. And this level, recommended level, is fairly consistent with other major organizations that make dietary guidelines, such as the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine. The vast majority of scientists and healthcare providers accept these guidelines. They're based on the totality of high quality published scientific literature we have on sodium. The levels were, these included meta-analyses, which critically appraised all of the research, and there was scientific consensus on the levels. However, there are a few researchers that have argued that people can tolerate well above that recommended amount of 2,000 milligrams of sodium per day without having adverse health effects. These researchers, it's only a handful of them, are challenging the scientific consensus that sodium poses a risk and that they feel sodium reduction is not needed and have said, you know, there's no need to have these, spend money on these public health initiatives because they're not going to be effective. But the reality is, the relative to the entire literature on sodium over the past 50 years, there are only a handful of studies that support these this hypothesis. And it's really important to know why these studies are controversial. The reason they're controversial are because of significant methodologic limitations. So I'll maybe just break down some of those, if you'll indulge me, what those methodological limitations are. So when we conduct studies, observational studies that look at the relationship between sodium and health, we need to measure the amount of sodium that people are eating. And the best way to measure the amount of sodium that people are eating is to have participants complete a 24-hour urine collection, which tells us approximately, it's an excellent estimate of how much sodium a person is eating in the day. We say it's the gold standard because almost all of the sodium we eat appears in our urine at the end of the day. So using this research method, for 24 hours, people will collect all of their urine in a big orange container. And it's not very fun, but people are very willing to do it for research, which is great. So where the controversial studies come in is where they didn't use a 24-hour urine collection to measure sodium intake. Instead, these studies use a quicker method to assess sodium intake, and that's what we call a spot urine collection. So many people listening might be familiar with, peeing in a bottle, a little jar at the doctor's office. That is exactly what a spot urine test is. And researchers will do this because it's only one small sample of urine collected at one point in time, and it's relatively easy to do. What they do is they take the amount of sodium in that small sample and they enter it into a mathematical equation to estimate daily sodium intake. And that's where the trouble is using this mathematical equation. What several researchers have done in the past few years is conducted some very eloquent studies to show that when we create relationships between dietary sodium and health, using that spot urine sample creates a flawed relationship. And they know that because they've compared a 24-hour urine collection and a spot urine sample in the same population. And so it's become, these studies have really created a lot of confusion in the literature and in the scientific community and healthcare community. What is very important, we should be aware of these studies and consider them because they are peer reviewed and published. And as scientists, we always want to take a rigorous methodological approach to critically appraising studies and to consider the findings. But we should not be putting as much weight on studies that have used the spot urine method. Not putting as much weight on them when we're looking at health risks associated with dietary sodium. So we would definitely put more weight on those that have used stronger methods like the 24-hour urine collection when looking at diet and disease relationships. So in other words, we just need to take caution when interpreting their conclusions. But for the most part, the majority of the scientific community is still focused on that 2000 milligram reduction in sodium. And given that most of our population is consuming levels beyond that, it's still calling for the need for public health interventions for sodium reduction.
Right. And I mean, the assessment methods are certainly important. So on that note, then how should we be interpreting these controversial studies?
Well, just interpreting them with caution, recognizing that they're there. I think that, you know, they should definitely not be used to inform guidelines or recommendations. One thing, if there are healthcare providers listening, is educating your team, especially if you're a dietitian who has influence in teaching medical residents, teaching other dietitians or other healthcare professionals, to make sure that these the messages and the guidelines that are coming from public health authorities are being translated and communicated to other healthcare professionals who may be recognizing this controversy and not knowing how to interpret it.
Right. Thank you for that. I think that's important to note. And although sodium has been a topic or a hot topic for debate, but regardless of this, the controversy, the reality is that most of us are consuming far more sodium than we need. And so reducing sodium intake has remained a public health priority for years. And I know this is an area where your research has made a significant impact. So as a leading expert in this field, can you share some of the most promising findings from the work that you're currently doing?
Yeah, maybe I'll talk about one of my most recent studies or series of studies that I find personally very exciting. So a couple years ago, we got funding from CIHR to conduct a series of research that's looking at factors that influence sodium intake in Canada. The ultimate goal was to administer a survey to 3,400 Canadians, assessing, you know, how people think about sodium, what behaviors they have around sodium, and what sort of environmental or personal factors are impacting their sodium intake. That survey, as we speak, is in the field. So it's very exciting because it means 2025, we're going to have tons of data. But to prepare for that study, we conducted qualitative research. Qualitative research has a benefit because we get to dive deep into what people are thinking about sodium, what their beliefs are, how aware they are. And so we had some really interesting findings for that I can share with you today. So one of the things that we found in that research was that most people could tell us what the negative health impacts of excess sodium were, which is very good. And it correlates with, you know, past survey research that indicates, you know, general knowledge levels of, you know, Canadians associating sodium with high blood pressure and cardiovascular disease. But what we interestingly found was that the people concerned about excess sodium were those that had a pre-existing health condition. It didn't have to be cardiovascular disease. It could have been a gastrointestinal condition or a lung condition. So it's very interesting just that the presence of a health condition made people more aware of sodium. Also, many of the people that we interviewed felt that their risk was low and that it was an issue to be dealt with in the future. So, you know, on one hand, we have the people who have health conditions, and everybody, as I mentioned earlier, there's benefits, you know, even for healthy people for reducing their sodium intake. But that future sort of, you know, thinking it's not going to happen to me now, my risk is low, and it's something to be concerned about when I'm older, was very interesting. And it suggests that, you know, maybe some of our public health interventions need to position the messaging a little bit differently. We also found that some participants felt that they didn't necessarily need to be worried about sodium, but they were worried about their family members' sodium intake. This happened with spouses, so people were worried about their spouse, and people were worried about their children, but not about themselves. We had one very interesting person share with us a situation where she reported saving, I say that quote unquote, her other family members from eating too much sodium. So she talked about eating her child's McDonald's French fries in order to save her daughter from the excess sodium that was going to come from the French fries, but was not concerned for herself. So just really like a really deep level, when you start to talk to people and hear their experiences, you hear these really interesting things. And we'll get to sort of look at this at a general population level. We are looking at it through our survey.
Do you?
So,
Sorry. I was just going to ask about the paper but go ahead, please finish and we'll.
This paper, it's a good question. This paper is in development. We're going to be submitting it for peer review in January when we come back from the holidays. So it's very interesting. What we're really finding is that cognitive biases are present and they're a real thing. People may have heard of cognitive biases before and how people, you know, perceive and interpret information. We can think about this as like an optimism bias, where the tendency of individuals to believe that they are less susceptible to the negative health impacts of sodium intake, such as hypertension or cardiovascular disease. They feel it for themselves. They feel they're not at risk, but that others are. So it's going to be interesting. We'll have more data on this coming up over the next year.
I look forward to that. And so I guess in general, do Canadians lack awareness about sodium and therefore not concerned about it? Is that sort of where things are?
So I think that generally, so what we know from past survey research, in Canada, this hasn't been done for over 12 years. We know that people are aware of sodium, but they have no idea. What we've learned from this qualitative research is that most people don't understand how it personally impacts them and how they should be concerned. So especially among some of the younger people, we study people of all ages. They said to us, if it's not on social media, it's not on their radar. You know, they feel like there's one quote, I can share it with you. This one young person who was probably in their mid to late 30s said, there's no awareness about sodium. There's nobody poking me. You know, even if in the form of articles, ads, or, you know, social media posts, nobody is talking about it. I don't care, because nobody is talking about it. So maybe sodium is not that important. And that said a lot. Some of the other folks we interviewed made suggestions also about more social media awareness. And they conflated the need for awareness related to sodium with smoking and vaping campaigns that they see as being highly effective to influence their behavior. And the younger folks said that they don't want to see an older person like me telling them that they should be reducing their sodium intake. They want to see people their own age. Which is really interesting. You know, they can't relate to older people. You know, when you think about creating empathy in public health campaigns, it's a really good example that we got to observe coming out of that work. So it's an obvious finding, but an interesting one that suggests that we have a lot of work to do as a public health community.
Absolutely. And maybe shifting gears a little bit. Thank you for sharing that, by the way. And it's exciting to hear about a lot of the innovative strategies you've been exploring to help people reduce their sodium intake, a lot of the research that you're doing. And we know that technology is playing an increasing role in the way we approach nutrition research and education, and also the tools to help track and reduce sodium intake. They're becoming more accessible with a lot of exciting developments. So are there any digital innovations or mobile apps or anything you've worked on or are working on or perhaps even can recommend that can assist individuals in tracking and reducing sodium consumption?
Yeah, so I've had the great opportunity to be able to be involved in using tech-based health interventions to support sodium reduction and healthy eating. So I work at Ontario Tech University, and with that comes the mandate, but also amazing collaborators that I can work on, you know, creating new advancements in this area. So very recently, my lab, with funding from Manulife, developed a web app educational tool. So it's like a website, and we called it Sodium 101. And it has a goal of educating the public about sodium. So we know that there's lots of different places on the internet where people can get information on sodium, but we felt that, and Manulife also felt that there was a need to have, you know, an expert group of individuals create an engaging tool to support, comprehensive tool to support sodium reduction. So you can find the website at www.sodium101.com. And the website really, it's quite holistic. It contains content all the way from the recommendations to sources of sodium, to tips and tricks to lower sodium intake, as well as quite an engaging module on how to read food labels, because we know that that's a huge part of being able to choose lower sodium foods at the grocery store or the point of purchase. And we aimed not just to create it as like a point and click website. We've actually included engaging features like quizzes and self-assessment tools and goal setting modules to really help the user engage and think about how they can apply the learning to their life. And that Sodium 101 was modeled off of an earlier app we had created specifically for heart failure patients called the Sodium Navigator HF, which was created by, led by a PhD student of mine, Bridvi Sivakumar. The other really very popular tool that we created is called the Sodium Calculator. The Sodium Calculator was created out of a need to connect people with their personal risk around sodium. And so what the Sodium Calculator is it's a dietary screener that provides a user with personalized feedback on the amount, an estimated amount of sodium that they would take in a day, how that compares to the recommendations, and then a ranking of the sources of sodium in their diet. So it provides kind of that targeted advice. So it might say most of the sodium is coming from restaurant foods. So you would know that, okay, I need to watch my intake at restaurants. So those are the tools. The Sodium Calculator can be accessed on the Project Big Life. It's housed on a server at the University of Ottawa.
Okay, these are great tools. I'm sure they will definitely be useful to our listeners. I think I'll probably check them out myself. And also, you did mention restaurant foods. And so we know that processed and restaurant foods are some of the biggest culprits when it comes to high sodium intake. And this is also a focus of your research. And so maybe you can talk a little bit about how that landscape has changed over the years and where you currently see the greatest opportunities for sodium reduction.
Mm-hmm. A lot of my research in the past has focused on the food supply. So both in Canada and in Latin American countries, the rationale for focusing on the food supply is that, again, most of the sodium in the Canadian diet, 85% of it, is coming from packaged and restaurant foods. And we know that if we can get food manufacturers to reduce the amount of sodium that they're adding to their foods, that we can have a meaningful impact on the amount of sodium that people are eating. So one of the common ways that, one of the recommended ways that countries go about doing this is by creating sodium reduction targets. So these targets set sort of a maximum amount of sodium that should be in a food relative to a population's food supply. So usually, you know, we get a big database of foods and we create cut points for what, you know, a certain amount of sodium would be to have a public health impact. So in 2012, Health Canada published a set of these sodium reduction targets. The way that Health Canada set their targets was to encourage a gradual reduction. So there were three different phases, and they wanted to have a gradual reduction because we know there's data to show that consumers can't detect small changes in reformulation for sodium reduction. So if it's done over a period of 5 years, then the idea was this, that we could change the food supply without negative impact on the sale of foods. So Health Canada published their initial set of targets in 2012, and then these were slightly updated in 2020 based on new data. However, since 2012, since the inception of the targets, the challenges is we've seen very little change in the mean levels of sodium intake in packaged foods. The changes are minimal, and it varies from, you know, time to time that where these measurements are taken, but it's quite minimal. A good illustration of this is when you look at the percentage of targets that are the percentage of foods, rather, that are meeting the sodium reduction targets. So when we first started monitoring sodium in foods in 2010, approximately 28% of food categories met the sodium reduction targets. And a more recent estimate suggests that 37% met the target. So over a period of time, several years, we're only seeing, you know, less than a 10% change or increase in the proportion of foods that are meeting the target. So this really suggests that there's a lot of work to do from food manufacturers to get their levels down to levels that are going to benefit public health. This paper that I'm just discussing about the 30%, 37% of foods, it was just published 2 weeks ago in the Journal of Applied Physiology, Nutrition, and Metabolism. And Anthea Christofferou from McMaster University was the first author on that paper. So if readers are interested in going to that, they can take a look.
Absolutely. And so I'm just wondering, you know, your thoughts, why are these sodium reduction targets not being effective?
They're largely... So Canada, when they published their targets, they chose to take a voluntary approach. What a voluntary approach means is that the food industry can choose to follow the targets or not. So the targets are mere guidance. Aside from some researchers like me and my colleagues, no one is really monitoring the sodium content of the food supply. Health Canada has done one analysis. But really there's no, because there's no monitoring, there's and no sort of public reporting of these levels, there's no incentive or disincentive for manufacturers to do it or not. So in other words, nobody's holding industry accountable, even if they make a public commitment to sodium reduction. So yeah, to me, that is one of the reasons they're not effective. On a slightly similar but slightly different topic, we also don't have sodium reduction targets for restaurant foods. And this is a big challenge. Restaurant foods can contain a day's worth of sodium, and we don't have any national menu labeling guidelines that include sodium. Some provinces will have calories but not sodium. And so restaurant foods are high and they're really tricky to navigate. So, yeah, we've got a lot of work to do there as well.
So are you suggesting that they be regulated?
The sodium reduction targets for packaged foods, my belief, based on the lack of progress we've seen over the past several years, is that they should be regulated. Other countries like Argentina and South Africa have regulated the maximum sodium levels for some key food categories in their countries. And this has been shown to be a very effective approach. I've chatted with food manufacturers, and, you know, people may think they would dislike it, but there are some benefits to it in a way, because it creates a level playing field for all foods in a food category. So if cereal A decides to reduce their sodium intake or sodium levels to a certain amount, there may be a perception, like a taste perception, like the taste is going to change. But if And then that might advantage cereal B. But if cereal B also has to reduce their sodium levels, then all products are being kind of evaluated. Obviously, there's going to be differences, but all products are going to be meeting that same target. So it can work either way in terms of how manufacturers would perceive such a regulation. But I think it's needed, and mainly because there's been little progress made. And it's time that we take more action and be serious about it, as opposed to just asking and asking and asking and having no or minimal response.
Right, of course. And even with all the tools and knowledge available, I know lowering sodium intake can be really challenging, especially when processed and restaurant foods sort of dominate our food environment. So along those lines, what are some of the biggest barriers individuals face when trying to lower their sodium intake?
So as you state, you know, the amount of sodium in packaged and restaurant foods is a significant barrier. So I would probably say, you know, access to lower sodium options is a problem, and it is something that people have identified to be a barrier. In relation to the food supply as well, for some people, the cost of lower sodium foods as part of a lower sodium dietary pattern can be a challenge, especially now with the increasing food prices that we're seeing in Canada. A low sodium diet contains more fresh vegetables, fruits, and meats. In our recent qualitative study, you know, people were even reporting like, I would buy hot dogs instead of fresh meats because they're less expensive or they're cheaper. That's just one example, but it happens, you know, throughout. A lot of clinicians will be able to give a lot of anecdotal evidence related to this. We've also found in our research that taste is a major barrier. So people love the taste of salt, and for some, it can seem like a really big sacrifice to not only reduce the salt, but also to change what our habits are in terms of flavor. So with dietary changes, you know, it's not just about changing the saltiness, it's what we've become accustomed to. And some traditional foods or homemade foods that we may have may require, you know, our recipes to be changed significantly. And that's hard for people. And, you know, it's a big cost, or it's a big price to pay for reducing sodium intake. Of course, there are ways to boost flavors with lower sodium foods, but humans are a creature of habit, and it's hard to change. We do have... there is a lot of new research around low sodium salts, not so much in Canada. It's an area that I'm hoping to study over the next couple of years. But internationally, there's a lot of research happening on low sodium salts, which was driven by a New England Journal of Medicine paper showing that it can result in substantive improvements in cardiovascular outcomes when low sodium salts, which contain potassium, more potassium instead of sodium, are used instead of, you know, a traditional sodium chloride salt. So what are some other barriers? I think I would say misconceptions as well about risk. And that links back to some of my earlier comments about, you know, personal risk and mostly people with health conditions being concerned. I think that having that concern and perceived risk is a major motivator to lowering sodium intake. And if you don't see the benefit to reducing sodium intake, you're not going to sort of sacrifice the taste and time and effort it requires in order to follow a lower sodium diet. So if that motivation is missing, the costs of following a low sodium diet are going to feel really steep. And that's where I was saying we need better interventions to start to change people's mindset around this. And then finally, the other thing I would say that we've seen in some of our data are just our changing culture and how food is food is involved in that. So people are busier. There's more demands on their time. People are resorting to convenience. So in some of our work, we've seen, young people just going, to campus or whatever is close to their home to grab food instead of preparing it at home themselves. You could say that is also food literacy skills are also integrated into that, with younger people not understanding how to cook or not having those skills, how to cook, how to choose foods. And we know, with changes over time in the school curriculum and also parents being busy, those food literacy skills have not perhaps been instilled in younger folks they were in the past. So yeah, there's a lot of barriers at multiple different levels. It's going to be interesting to see how we can begin to address some of these barriers in a different way in coming years.
Of course. And this is maybe not a follow-up question, but you made me think of something about, you mentioned the low sodium salts. Mm-hmm. And I sort of thought of, the pink salts and Himalayan salts. And, people tend to think those are healthier, but just quickly, maybe if you can comment on that. What are your thoughts? Is it the same thing? Is it the same sodium amount of sodium? This question has come up a lot.
It's a really good question. I have to say, in my social circles, in my class that I teach in at school at the university, it's a very common misconception. People think that if they use sea salt or kosher salt, for example, that's a way to lower the amount of sodium in their diet. And that is absolutely not the case. These kosher salt and sea salts, for example, they still contain roughly amount of the sodium as what a regular table salt would. You talked about the pink Himalayan salts. That is the exact same scenario. So there's pink Himalayan salts, there's the lava salts or selgree. They're beautiful. I see them in health food stores and they're very attractive. But they do also have comparable amounts of sodium to a regular table salt. So you might get different flavors that come from those salts or the satisfaction, they look pretty. But they're not a substitute for sodium. Where we would substitute sodium is with the low sodium salts, which is when we add more potassium chloride to a salt mixture to give it. So potassium chloride tastes salty. So it's a way of giving salt by adding more potassium chloride sometimes with the sodium chloride. It gives it the salty taste, but has less sodium in it. And then potassium also has, the more potassium we have in our diet, the better it is for our cardiovascular system. So there's that reciprocal relationship between sodium and potassium. So the low sodium salts have a dual effect.
Right. I appreciate you clarifying that because I've heard this question many times and I thought this is the perfect place to finally discuss this. So maybe we can wrap up and sort of look at the big picture because, the idea of cutting back on sodium, can feel overwhelming for many and it's hidden in so much of what we eat. But what are some simple steps people can take today to start reducing their sodium intake without feeling overwhelmed? And I know you did mention the low sodium salts, but if you have any other tips or recommendations, that would be great.
Yeah, I think really at a high level, when you think about reducing your sodium, assessing those barriers. So many of the barriers that we just talked about, they're independent of food selection, many of them. So it's really just looking holistically about what some of those barriers are for you. So that could be, I don't really think I have a lot of risk, or I'm not old enough to be worrying about this, or I don't have a health condition. Think about what's really standing in the way of you appreciating the risk to you now. And you can do that You can also sort of think about your personal risk by doing something like the sodium calculator, that we talked about earlier, where you can get a sense of how much sodium you're eating, what are the major sources of sodium in the diet, and then visit, not that I'm self-promoting, but you could visit our tool, sodium101.com, to really get, you know, grounded guidance and advice for reducing sodium, as well as think about some of the goals that you could set personally, SMART goals, in order to reduce your sodium intake. At a more specific level, we've talked about some of these things today, but, you know, really, I would say limiting the amount of times you eat out in a day for some people, in a week for others. Most restaurant foods contain substantive amounts of sodium, and this, even just reducing the number of times you eat out, is a really easy way to start reducing the amount of sodium that you're eating. Reading food labels. So, you know, reading the nutrition facts table, looking for foods that have 5% or less daily value for sodium, looking at claims on the front of package that might indicate a food is low in sodium or reduced sodium. And soon, with regards to labels, in about a year, in 2026, we'll soon have warning labels. And the warning labels, as many listeners may know, will indicate a food is high in sodium, saturated fat, or sugar if it crosses a certain threshold. And that's going to be on the front of the pack, and it's standardized, and it's going to be a really easy way for people to avoid those foods with those nutrients of concern, including sodium. And then finally, you know, limiting intake of processed foods will also have a big impact, using food labels to choose the best, you know, the healthier choice of lower sodium choice of processed foods, and shifting sort of food choices. Like, so you'd want to shift more to using fresh foods at home, having fresh vegetables, fresh protein foods that aren't canned. We know that, you know, when meats are processed or foods are canned, they're often having sodium added to them to act as a preservative. So you could switch to fresh options or also frozen, because frozen vegetables, for example, does not have sodium added. Frozen mixed meals is another story. Those can be salt bombs. So those are things to sort of watch out for. Your mixed meals in the frozen food section, or mixed meals in canned food section, are always like relatively higher in sodium. And then, you know, most Canadians are not adding a lot of sodium using salt, but you could think about using those low salt, the salt substitutes. You can also think about adding flavor in other ways, like adding lemon to fish or using dried herbs and spices to flavor protein foods like rosemary or thyme, or, you know, there's a lot of different herbal mixes. But what you want to stay away from are spice seasonings and flavorings that contain sodium. And you can usually identify these from the nutrition facts table or the ingredients list. They're often the first ingredient in the ingredients list. And these are things like Montreal steak spice, masala spices for curries, bouillon that, you know, people might add to recipes, or rice, to give it a boost of flavor. So those are things to watch out for.
I think I'll have to take a look at my pantry again here. But those are great tips, Joanne. Yeah. Thanks so much. This has been such an informative and thought-provoking discussion. And we've explored everything from differences between salt and sodium to the health impacts of high sodium intake, the ongoing controversies in the field, and also innovative strategies to help Canadians reduce their sodium consumption. And you've shared practical advice and discussed some of the challenges we face as individuals and as a society in tackling this public health issue. So I know that our listeners will definitely walk away with a greater awareness of sodium and some actionable steps to make healthier choices. So thank you so much for taking the time to join us today and for sharing your expertise.
Thank you for having me. It was actually fun.
Thanks, Joanne.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Nutrition Conversations. We hope that you found today's discussion informative and inspiring. If you're interested in hearing more about the latest research in nutrition and health, be sure to check out our website at cns-scn.ca/podcast for upcoming episodes. You can find us on various platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and more. Simply search for the Nutrition Conversations podcast on your favorite app, and you'll have access to all our episodes in one place. We release new episodes at the end of each month, so mark your calendars and stay tuned for upcoming episodes. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode.